Welcome to Branching Out, a podcast presented by the reporters and editors of the Acorn newspapers, offering you a closer look at the news in your community.
So this is Branching Out. It is Monday, September 28th. Thanks for tuning in. Kyle and I are talking today with Jeremy Wolf from California State Senator Henry Stern's office. Jeremy, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely honored and thrilled to be here.
So we told you we'd be discussing. There's a couple things we wanted to talk about, and some inauspicious timing, maybe, to do with one of them. Let's start with the wildlife bridge. For our listeners who aren't aware, there was a mountain lion hit and killed on the 101 freeway yesterday, and this wildlife bridge, which would go in at Liberty Canyon, is a proposed way to solve that problem, keep it from happening in the future. Tell us about it.
Yeah, the proximity, especially, Jeremy, yeah. Right, has a lot to do why people, again, are connecting this with the need for the bridge.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We've seen mountain lions be killed on the freeway in that corridor often, and it goes to show the importance of building this wildlife corridor. This was an uncollared mountain lion, but for a lot of the collared mountain lions where they can see their locations, they see them go up to where the wildlife corridor is roughly going to be built and turn back around because they can't find a safe route across the freeway. And so this guy was brave and just went for it. And it didn't turn out too well.
Yeah. Now, just to clarify for our listeners, when you say collared, there is a National Park Service study going on where they will collar mountain lions with GPS trackers. If you are at all familiar with the Acorn, you're familiar with this. We write about it pretty regularly. But just to clarify.
Yeah, I mean, because it's interesting how we rarely see them uncollared, especially, I don't know, have they just said the age of this cat? I mean, it looked like the larger one.
NPS is only picking it up for the necropsy today, so they had no information about
it. But usually they're able, it's amazing to find these cats and get them collared by this age, so to have an uncollared one. But Jeremy, I think when we hear some of the critics of the wildlife bridge say, you know, what's going to make these animals actually use it? You know, is there a sign they're going to follow? But what's interesting about this location, you pointed out, for whatever reason, and maybe you can explain to our listeners, we've seen a lot of cats killed near this area. So clearly the cats are using this area to cross. I mean, this location, it was picked for a reason, right? I mean, it's...
Absolutely. And I have a lot to say about the wildlife corridor at Liberty Canyon. I grew up in Liberty Canyon, too. That's where my parents live. So it has a special importance. In this project, I was an intern with Fran Pavley when I had long hair. And that's where I first met Henry. And that's what really got me involved in this project. And it's just so fascinating because of the location. What are the chances that there'd be parkland, open space on both sides of the freeway? It's the only place in the whole Conejo Valley where there's open space on both sides of the freeway. So to paint a picture for everyone listening, the Santa Monica Mountains is an island habitat. We have the Pacific Ocean to the south. We have the Oxnard Plain to the east. And to the west, we have the LA Basin, the second most populated urban center in the United States. Cutting through the Santa Monica Mountains is the 101 freeway, and I like to think of it as an electric fence. And it's trapping the mountain lions in the mountain range. And I'll talk about the wide range of issues that causes. But this location is so incredibly special because it has open space on both sides, and it's kind of a funnel. The science shows that they do go towards that location. And I do want to be clear, though, that the mountain lion is the main character of this story. But this is for deer. This is for bobcats. This is for coyotes, lizards, birds. This is not just a mountain lion corridor. This is for genetic diversity in the entirety of the Santa Monica Mountains.
I think that's something that gets lost on readers a lot. Like the genetic diversity part of it, because they're, like you say, it's islands. Like P-22 is trapped within 8 square miles of Griffith Park unless it wants to risk crossing 2 freeways again. It's hard for these animals to find mates. It's hard for them to find food, and that is leading to dwindling populations and inbreeding and stuff. And I think the other thing that needs to get mentioned, because I see this all the time in comments, and it always just drives me the littlest bit crazy, well, more and more as the longer I've done this, is people saying, like, why don't we just relocate these animals to the Angeles National Forest? And I'm sure you know, mountain lions need like 200 square miles of territory to themselves. And if we relocate them, we're basically just putting them in a battle royale of who's going to kill who. And diminish the population that way.
Absolutely. And I get that question all the time.
Yeah, relocating, right?
The relocating, yeah. Or why can't you just bring a new mountain lion and drop it in the Santa Monica Mountains? And you can't mess with Mother Nature like that.
Yeah.
These are very sensitive ecosystems and social structures. Male mountain lions are extremely territorial.
Yeah.
Mountain lion infighting is one of the leading cause of deaths in the Santa Monica Mountains. There's only one reproducing male, collared male, in the Santa Monica Mountains, and they need a very large territory. So you can't mess with Mother Nature and just bring one in, because you're setting it up for failure. It's fascinating the amount of room that they need,
yeah,
the territories they need, and that they're able to even find that still in our mountain range. So that's why the balance is so incredibly delicate, and it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
There's no science that shows that this works, will work, or has ever worked, bringing in new mountain lions and humans placing them there.
And what about moving them? I hear that a lot too. Taking them to another habitat. What's the issue there?
I take offense almost to that statement, because this is their home range that we have encroached upon, that they have managed to eke out a survival. It shows the resiliency of wildlife, that these big cats are able to survive and in some cases thrive here in the Santa Monica Mountains. And in no way should we be removing them.
Like kicking them out, like, we're here now, you gotta go.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's outrageous. And they're important for the ecosystem, for managing a deer population, for having these big predators is beneficial for the overall ecosystem. So removing them would be detrimental to the ecosystem.
The other side of that too, it's, if you'll allow me to get cute, it's kicking the cat down the road. It's like, okay, it's a problem in our neighborhood. Let's go put it somewhere else, and then it'll be some other neighborhood's problem, because it'll start moving into other territories or like residential areas. And I don't think a lot of people think of when they say, oh, let's just relocate them. It's like it's going to end up in someone else's backyard.
I mean, this is a particularly challenging area for them.
Oh, no, like you said, denying that at all.
With the freeway there and with the big population. Jeremy, while we have you here, I mean, I forgot. So you were an intern in Fran Pavley's office. So you go way back. I mean, so now I get the tree with Henry. And so what, for people that don't know, were you there? Who first came up with this idea? Was someone just...
That's a really great question. But the year that they attribute to the first time that the wildlife corridor as an idea was introduced was 1991. Wow. And the Park Service mountain lion study started in 2002. I don't know who was the first person to come up with it, but there was plans in 1991. But it's important to talk about, when we talk about Liberty Canyon, the engineering behind it that makes it currently a wildlife corridor. There's an underpass still underneath it, and that's functioning as the wildlife corridor. So by a mistake of engineering, with open space on both sides at Liberty Canyon, it happens to be right now the only place where they are able to cross underneath. But there's still freeway off-ramps and Agoura Road and development that makes it challenging. But for two purposes why it's such an ideal location, because of the parkland on both space and the undercrossing that's currently there.
Yeah.
Now, can you speak, because I know we've done stories about there's one cat who did learn to use that culvert as a way to get across, and some people are saying, well, it's already there. Like, that is sufficient. Why do we need to spend millions of dollars? Why do we need to interrupt traffic?
Large animals do not like being in confined spaces. The culverts, it's too small. It's not a viable solution. The culvert cat, I think they called it.
Yeah.
Brilliant, amazing. It shows how nature finds a way, but that's not a viable long-term solution.
Yeah.
It's their behavior. It shows that they don't like small, enclosed places. They like to feel open.
Yeah.
And really, all large mammals in the Santa Monica Mountains wouldn't use that as a viable crossing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I first heard the idea, it was almost surreal. I admit, I've never seen one of these bridges before. I've never been on one. I've now seen photos. I think there's a couple. There's no others in the lower 48, right? Are there? I mean, I've seen some in Canada, I think in like Norway or Sweden, but they're rare. Why don't we see more of these? I mean, they are an engineering challenge, right? The circumstances have to be just right.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's a few in Montana and Wyoming. Okay. And the ones in Canada and the ones in the other countries are on these roads with two lanes, with minimal traffic. I mean, what we're trying to do here is just amazing. The scope of the project. But we didn't take wildlife movement into consideration in our planning. That wasn't even a thought. Some of these other countries were taking it into consideration before, but it's only now that we've realized the human problem we've created requires a human solution. And it's here in the Santa Monica Mountains, Los Angeles, we really care about our wildlife. And interestingly enough, there's two major cities in the world that have big cats in it. Mumbai has leopards, and Los Angeles has mountain lions.
Wow.
And so we have to do everything in our power, in my opinion, to preserve the population of mountain lions in the Santa Monica Mountains and our wildlife. There's a 25% chance, if nothing gets done, that within 50 years, the mountain lion population will go extinct. And that's on the low end. But guaranteed 25%, they will go extinct in 50 years if nothing's done.
How close are we? We've been talking about this bridge so long, but we're finally, right? I mean, we're actually starting to talk about seeing some kind of construction is possibly next year. Can you give us any kind of, what's the latest on the timeline? And obviously funding, we haven't talked about that yet. Maybe you can address both. I mean,
so the project's hoping to be shovel ready beginning of 2022.
Okay.
Starting construction, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And we're still in the fundraising phase. So this is a private-public partnership with a capital P on the private, small p on the public. However, the state has stepped up. They gave a $5 million grant to this project 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, which was really exciting. And there's been other grant money. It's not general fund money. And I want to be clear to our listeners that none of these funds that have gone towards the project would have been used for other services. This is purely money that has already been set aside for wildlife movement and these sorts of projects.
Right.
So we've kind of tapped out the government side for the funding. Now the lion's share of the funding needs to come from the private. And there's some really exciting opportunities that the Save LA Cougars campaign is looking into, some big donors with naming rights. And so once that ball gets rolling, we're pretty confident we'll reach the finish line. But there's people, you know, there's a couple in Kansas who read about the story and gave $100,000.
Wow.
There's elementary school students that are giving $5. With the mountain lion that was killed this week, they raised $13,000 in 5 hours.
Wow.
From posting about it.
Oh, wow. GoFundMe or just Save LA
Cougars? Save LA Cougars, yeah.
Because it does seem like a long way, let's be honest. I mean, this thing is not going to – we've seen a lot of different estimates. I think we're now somewhere in the neighborhood of $75 or $80 million. Seems like we've got a long way to go, but everyone seems to be pretty confident we'll get there, Jeremy. I hate to focus on that, but that's a big part of this. Do you think – I mean, how many years it might take to get the money we need? I mean, the idea is to get little by little and do it in phases, right, in some way?
Totally, and it's a very valid question because these are big numbers, right? This is not a small...
Trying to build a local park or something, yeah.
Exactly, these are really large numbers. But the scale of this project and the exposure it's gotten worldwide, I mean, this is becoming known throughout the world in environmental circles. So I am confident that we will get there, but we do need a large donation, like in the $30 million range, to get the ball really rolling, to because once other donors see that people are coming in, then they'll follow, and I'm confident that we'll get there.
Where's Bezos on this?
Yeah, right.
Right, and that's what we need to tap.
I mean, I think it's worth mentioning that right now you're wearing a shirt with a mountain lion on it that says Save Our Wildlife. Is
absolutely,
that right?
Absolutely, on purpose.
Yeah,
just for today's interview. Well,
you know this isn't a videotape.
We'll get a photo later. Yeah. But the other thing that we wanted to talk to, and this is me pivoting towards that, is it's not just mountain lions that are at issue here. There's another issue that is actually indirectly impacting them, which is rat poison, rodenticides. We just wrote a story about a bill that passed through the state Senate regarding that. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. And then I do want to discuss like the biodiversity of the Santa Monica Mountains as a whole.
Yeah.
Now I want to use that as a starting place, that this is a Mediterranean ecosystem. There's 5 Mediterranean ecosystems in the world. They cover 2% of the Earth's population, but they hold 20% of plant life. Like, those numbers are insane. The biodiversity that we find here in the Santa Monica Mountains and then California as a whole is just so important to protect. And we're learning how important biodiversity is in, you know, wide range of life. And so here in the Santa Monica Mountains, it's especially important with the rodenticide poisoning. And that's why this bill that's now sitting on the governor's desk that should be signed any day now, hopefully. It's called AB 1788, and it's authored by Assemblymember Richard Bloom, co-authored by Senator Henry Stern. And what it does, it will place a moratorium on second-generation anticoagulant use. And what those are, they're the black bait boxes. And I became involved in this with an organization called Poison Free Malibu in 2013. And that's first when it got on my radar. And they showed me what a bait box was.
Yeah.
And once you see it, you can't unsee them. They're
in
everywhere.
Our courtyard. They're all over our building. I notice them all the time.
They are everywhere. It's unbelievable. And basically what it is, it's a poison delivery system. A rat goes into it, or a squirrel. It eats it. It dies in 3 or 4 days. And then it's picked up by wildlife. It's an easy snack. And it's not just mountain lions or bobcats, but it's birds of prey who are actually suffering the most. There's about 26 animals that are really affected by it, and most of them are actually birds.
Yeah.
Hawks, right?
Hawks, owls, crows. I mean, these birds are pretty they're not that picky eaters.
No, they're voracious. Yeah.
So they find these easy snacks, and what happens is the poison builds up in their system, and these animals die a slow, painful death from ingesting these rats that have eaten the poison.
Right.
So this bill is a way to kind of curb that. It's a starting point.
Right.
I'm really thrilled that it finally got through the legislature. This legislative session was extremely difficult to get anything passed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that 1788 is one of the biggest environmental wins in the state of California once the governor signs it. So it's a really big deal, and it's cool that it came out of the Santa Monica Mountains, but it's going to affect the entire state.
Why has it been so challenging? Is it just because of the business lobby and because they've become so dependent on these and relied on these poisons for so long? What was standing in the way?
Yeah, that's such a great question. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. Right, there's agriculture interests, there's pesticide interests, there's a lot more money to be made in promoting these products than in not. Residential exterminators push them on everybody.
Yeah.
And they're not the most effective tool in keeping your home free of rodents. And so the business interest is what's kept it from crossing that finish line. And there's some big exemptions in this bill. You know, agriculture land is exempt. Schools are exempt. There's some other notable exemptions. So it's not perfect, but it's a great starting point.
Well, I wanted to say, because one thing I'll give credit to Poison Free Malibu, and they have had quite an impact. You've got to say, from a group that just started out of was Malibu, and they've been the movement to lead. Now we have, right, Jeremy, no cities in our area use these anymore. Most of the government agencies have given them up, long given them up, and that was, I think, citizen-led that got us there. But to someone who's listening, and any homeowner that's ever had rats invade their house and dealt with that, or business, I think what Poison Free Malibu, one of the important things they do is talk about alternatives. Are there truly alternatives to these poisons that are effective? I mean, is it a trade-off? I mean, do we have to live with rats occasionally invading our homes if we're going to save the wildlife, or is there a way to handle them without these poisons?
And that's a fantastic question. That is the question when this comes up. And, you know, I want to make it really clear that we're not pro-rat here. Rats are big pests, and we don't want them in your home. So there's exclusion techniques.
Yeah.
There's ways to keep keep pests out of your house that don't include poison. There's some really easy ones, and I can't speak to all of them right now, but if you go to poisonfreemalibu.com, there's extremely simple things that homeowners can do that make your house less vulnerable to pests.
Yeah.
And these are non-poisonous solutions. Even traps. I mean, we support using the traps.
Well, one thing we were talking about before we got on the air is just the quote-unquote messiness of it, the labor that has to go into it. Like, individual traps, people have to go out and set them, they have to clean them, and then they have to, like, deal with the aftermath of a rat being crushed. And that's a harder thing, I think, for a lot of people to a harder toll to deal with.
Hey, rather than throwing out some poison and putting it in a box.
And it's symbolic of our society. Out of sight, out of mind. I don't want to deal with it. I don't care about the huge ramification this has on the entire ecosystem. I don't have to see it.
Yeah.
And that's problematic. And that these are societal changes, you know, that we need to incrementally make.
Yeah.
You know? Sorry, getting phone calls.
You're a popular guy. We know.
No, we get it. Well, I think, and is this fair to say? I mean, again, And I know you made the point, this isn't just about the mountain lions, but they have a way of crystallizing an issue, right? I mean, because this is affecting so many. But it felt like when the National Park Service really started to do their study and say, and bobcats, the amount of these poisons they were finding in some of these animals, coyotes as well, that's when people really started to take notice. I mean,
that photo of P22 with mange in the cage, like when they realized it was from the rodenticides, it's like a powerful thing.
That's exactly what I was going to point to. The image of P22 has become the mascot. I mean, P22 is world famous. The fact that this big cat, like you mentioned earlier, crossed two freeways. And then seeing the physical deformities that these poisons cause on these animals, 96% of mountain lions that have been captured and tested come up positive for rodenticides. I mean, this is destroying these populations, and it's a complete, it's another human-made hurdle that we've created for their survival. Just doesn't stop.
No, it's, oh, you got two of them, too.
Wait a second.
It just doesn't stop. So seeing the image of P22 and understanding the pain and suffering that humans are causing these animals when it's not needed necessarily. There's other solutions, there's other techniques to prevent these type of from rats coming to your home. That's really what it comes down to.
Do we move on to the next?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I think you wanted to talk about, you've been doing a lot of work with a creek cleanup here locally. I mean, you do a lot on the environment. I know that's something else you're passionate about.
Yeah, we should say this is an awkward episode a little bit because you're on here now. This is going to air Monday, but tomorrow you're leading the annual creek cleanup.
Absolutely, yeah. So this is going to be my it's going to be my ninth year doing this creek cleanup with the city of Agoura and Heal the Bay. We've removed close to 30,000 pounds of trash from the Medea Creek and surrounding waterways. I think it's a little bit more depending on which tabulations I use. But this all started, Elise Buckley Weber, who's currently the mayor, reached out to me in 2012. And said, hey, there's this Heal the Bay cleanup, and they're looking for someone to organize for an Agoura location, for an inland site. Mm-hmm. So it's part of Coastal Cleanup Day, which is actually the world's largest volunteer day, where they get volunteers from all over the world. They have sites, and it's focused on beach cleanups. But this one's an inland site, preventing the trash from reaching the ocean. So every year we would meet on the corner of Canaan and Agoura Road, and we'd have about 150 to 200 people come. And what's interesting about this corner is that there's a lot of dumping that goes on there. So that's really where a lot of the weight from our trash comes from. But there's still dumping trash into a pristine ecosystem. So we get volunteers from every walk of life, from high school students to retired seniors who come out and just want to, you know, they feel good about helping out their community. And that's the thing about a trash pickup is that you're tangibly doing something. Yeah. You know, you see the difference you're making. You're going out there, you're filling up a trash bag. And by the end of the day, you're looking at this trash bag saying, hey, if I didn't pick this up, this would still be sitting in this creek bed. Yeah. And so like that's a good rewarding feeling. So people really respond to that. This year, due to COVID, we're doing something different. We're going to be doing three locations throughout the city of Agoura and three different waterways, totally social distance. We're limiting the amount of volunteers, but we're going to new locations that we haven't picked up trash for before. So it's going to be interesting and different, but wanted to find a way to get the community out and you know, do something that they feel makes a difference.
Yeah. Are you concerned about turnout, or do you think it's going to be affected? I mean, I would think people have been kind of locked up and they're going to look forward to doing something like that. Have you already started taking signups? Is there going
to... Yeah, we're limiting it. We're going to have to turn people away.
Oh, because nuts, so you don't want to get crowding.
Yeah, we cannot go over a certain number due to county restrictions and state restrictions. And I don't want to, working for someone in the government, I don't want to be the one saying you can't be gathering together and then bringing people together.
Now, we were speaking earlier and you were saying this year is a little different as well because it's not Coastal Cleanup Day, but it's Coastal Cleanup Month, or?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. So this is all through Heal the Bay.
Yeah.
And this year they were figuring out what to do, and this year they did Coastal Cleanup Month. So the entire month of September, from September 1st to the 26th, which is the date of the cleanup, they're calling Coastal Cleanup Month. And they're encouraging small groups to go to watersheds, mountain areas, and beaches to clean up trash. Okay. And, you know, the number one item every year is cigarette butts. It's wild. That is by
still? Still. I mean, who's still smoking cigarettes? Everyone's vaping these days. Still.
Wow. A lot of folks are. Wow. And it's fascinating the stuff we find. I found a $20 bill one year. Find a chainsaw.
I'm excited.
Yeah, right.
Ian may be the first.
That's the real lottery of doing this. It's trash, but you might get lucky.
But that's amazing. People just. I mean, it's hard to think. People seem to be so environmentally aware out here, and yet you still year in and year out you find lots of trash. Right.
Lots.
You guys have found some really. I remember writing when you guys found like a couch or like a massive like concrete. I've done stories on this for the last like 2 or 3 years, and just the list of stuff that you guys will pull out is mind-boggling.
It's wild, yeah. Because waterways are trash bins for a lot of people, partly because you can't see what you're doing down there, and partly because it's easy and you know that no one's going to catch you.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of dumping that goes on, but there's also a lot of kids that go and hang out there, and interestingly enough, White Claws. I scouted out all the creeks. At every single creek, there's White Claw cans.
I told you they're
20
evil,
years
Kyle.
Ago was Zima, and now I guess it's White Claws. Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, but without fail, every single creek that I scouted out has White Claws in it. And it's funny because I look at these creeks and I want them to be clean, but I'm also like, okay, good, there's trash for volunteers to
right.
Like, I don't want it to be too, you know, I want the volunteers to have something to do. But Agora, they do a good job.
Are you having White Claw parties the night before these clean
to give volunteers an extra to do.
You know, I know you said you normally do Medea Creek, but I think this is a good way to kind of segue into our next topic, is development in Agora Hills. There's the West Village Project and the East Village Project. I keep getting the names confused, but one of them is going to be built in that Medea Creek area. What is that? Like, how is that going to
work? We should say you're on the Planning Commission.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Agora Hills. We never pointed that out. So.
Yes. Yeah. So, I'm a planning I'm Deborah Klein Lopez, as Planning Commissioner for the City of Agora Hills. It's been the most amazing thing, fascinating thing, being on this Planning Commission. I absolutely love it.
I love planning commissions. Can I just say that? I just find them so interesting. You have
I'm going to put that on a t-shirt for you.
Don't mean to interrupt you, but I just want to speak on my, you know, the city council, they deal with a lot, but sometimes the planning commissions are obviously the first ones where we see some of these larger projects, and sometimes, you know, they're the ones that have the public is most focused on that people really realize, and I don't think people realize how important that role is for the planning commission.
Absolutely. And I joked, I said that it was the JV team and the city council, the varsity team, but I've kind of changed my stance on that because you're making really important decisions. Do we approve this house? Do we not approve this house? Do we approve this development that's going to change the what Agora Hills looks like? Do we not? We spent 3 weeks discussing a gas station sign. And I love that. I think that's phenomenal that we got together for 3 different meetings to discuss colors and brightness of signs. But I mean, that just shows how much we as a body care about the community and the small details that, you know, make up the character.
Well, it's funny because when things go wrong, that's when people will never let you hear the end of it. I mean, I know certain apartment buildings I drive by and I think, geez, what was that planning commission?
Yeah, but the flip side of that, I'm sure people, 3 weeks discussing a gas sign, just like ripping their hair, like who would do that?
I love it. I love every second of it. I love, there's these big packets that I know that I could read that much. And it's just, it's become, I look forward to it now. And so that's fascinating. I know you brought up those 2 developments.
Yeah, let's talk about the big ones, yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to speak too much on the details, but I do want to start off with that I look at all development now through the Woolsey Fire lens.
Yeah.
So anything I look at, I think about how would this deal with a wildfire or a natural disaster. So that is one concern I have regarding that that intersection. It's very crowded. Summer traffic has been wild these last few years. I mean, it's backed up there.
We're talking Canaan.
Thank you.
You make the mistake of turning down Canaan Road on the wrong day. It's like, well, I'm stuck here for 45
minutes. Forever. But look, they're part of the Agora Village specific plan. And it falls into a lot of the parameters. Now, can we look at it and make some changes? Possibly. And I don't want to speak about that right now. But I am concerned regarding emergency preparedness for that specific project. But the developers have been pretty receptive to change. And
So in talking about, how about, since you can't really talk about future projects you may have to vote on, how could you give an idea of someone who, now you're from Agora, right? I mean.
Yes, sir.
Was it, it's born and raised? Or?
Raised. Moved here when I was in first grade.
Okay. Is it Agoran? Agoraite?
But interestingly enough, my parents, I grew up in Liberty Canyon, and they're one house outside the Agora city limit. So I went to vote for an Agora city election for, and they said, you're not on the list. Like, how am I not on the list? I'm registered. And they showed me the map, and it's like, you're not in the city of Agora.
Yeah, you're unincorporated.
Yeah, unincorporated LA County. So they're working to get – I moved, so now I live in Agora proper.
But they made – how can you at least remark on some of the progress they have made? And I lived in Agora for a number of years. I do think it's impressive what they've done along Agora Road in terms of, you know, at least where they are putting the development and Wizens and – because they're always trying to strike a balance, right, again, between preserving Agora, just like we talk about with Thousand Oaks and how people see Agora, but also having a local economy, local businesses. Yeah.
Right, and the balance is it's a dance. Mm-hmm. And so I remember when I moved to Agora, I remember driving out here and looking at the hillsides and thinking to myself, wow, I'm so glad that they forgot to develop this, or they didn't know to develop this. And then as I got older, I realized, no, there was people that fought tirelessly for years and years to protect and preserve Santa Monica Mountains. And partly why I'm interested in the Planning Commission is for my love of the Santa Monica Mountains, right? It's a finite area of land, right? Not that big. But we talked about the biodiversity in it earlier. Once you develop it, it's developed forever. You lose that acre by acre. We're losing some of the most biodiverse habitats in the world, right? So development is a sacred. You have to be very sure of where you are and what you're doing. And we need more housing, right? It's just, where do we put it? So we need creative solutions now. And with COVID, I think seeing how the economy changes with big box stores, with more online shopping, looking at rezoning like Westlake Village did some of these areas and possibly turning commercial into housing and, using existing footprints that are already here instead of going into our WUI, our wild urban interface.
I never heard that. Well, that brings me to a topic. I hope you don't mind. We touch on one that I love talking about. If you listen to the last week's podcast,
more
you
than planning
that.
Commissions,
more than planning commissions is housing and the debate that's going on. And I think you said we'd eventually love to have Senator Stern on here to talk about this. But hopefully, you can kind of shed some light on the challenges that he's dealing with as someone who is very much pro environment, preserving the mountains, preserving what we have, also. Been on the record about local control, letting cities make these decisions regarding housing. And yet we see, especially in the Democratic Party, a real push to, take away, to try to get, I guess, break this logjam with housing. And I think we can all acknowledge there's a housing crisis going on. We're lacking it and trying to find that balance. And Henry's really had to walk the line there, I think. Can you talk about how he's trying to do that and maybe especially hit on some of the larger housing votes and some of these bills and where he's come down on them.
Absolutely. And the good senator is committed to come on here, okay, so you can grill him on these also. But this is one of the biggest issues in the state legislature. And the complexities are mind-numbing. So I want to start with California is the most diverse, largest state in the nation. And we have a housing crisis. How do we fix it? How do we – yeah, it does – because everyone wants to live here. Why wouldn't they want to live here? How do we start to address these issues? Do we come up with policies that are – and this is said a lot, but a one-size-fits-all policy. So what works in Northern California might not work in Southern California. And there's this big narrative that the San Francisco Democrats are controlling the state. And I don't totally buy into that. I will say that what works in San Francisco doesn't work in Los Angeles. What works in parts of Los Angeles doesn't work in Agora Hills, right? So there, as an office, we support local control. It's extremely important. But we need to make sure that we are getting to the numbers of housing that we need to. But, what does that look like? And I don't agree with mandating the state mandating these cities to have to do certain things. I do think that they need housing and they need incentives to build housing. But it's a delicate balance, right? 1120 was one of the biggest, most high-profile bills that didn't didn't pass because of the dysfunction in the legislature this year. But Senator Stern, my boss, was the only person to not record a vote on it because he looks through everything of the lens of fire safety also.
Yeah.
And just didn't think that this bill took in consideration the importance of thinking about, is this, are we taking into consideration, if we're going to make each lot split into four, how are people going to evacuate during an emergency? What does that look like? What's parking look like? You know, so these are really tough, tough decisions that sometimes don't make us popular, but we...
Within your own party.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the issue there. And it seems like each year it's a new bill, right? I mean, every legislative session is a new way of looking at this, another chance. But when I tell people, and I'm on the record and I can editorialize here about, you know, my desire and the Acorn's position has been to that we can handle these issues locally with housing, that with our general plan, with how our city councils operate, we can handle it locally. Do you think the senator and you still believe that? I mean, because a lot of people point to, like, well, look, this is how we got here to begin with. Neighborhoods rising up saying, I don't want this in my backyard, no housing. Are you starting to see, I mean, is there a reason to have faith that housing can get done without some of these hard, you know, heavy-handed bills? And
I'm going to be very political,
okay.
But there's no yes or no answer on this. But you're absolutely right that in some instances, the cities haven't stepped up and they've drawn a line in the sand, and the state kind of does need to give them a little feet under their fire.
Put their feet to the fire.
There we are. But you can't strip local control fully.
Yeah.
So we need to find a middle path to this. It's a crisis. We have a housing crisis. Young people can't afford to buy houses. Young people can't afford to live or buy homes in the communities they grew up in. There's absolutely a housing shortage, but where do we put it, right? Do we go into our open space? Do we, you know, so there's so much complexity to it that coming up with this is how we're going to do it, one size fits all doesn't work.
Yeah.
So we support local control, but there is a role. The state definitely has a role to play in this.
How do you see a lot of people don't like when we touched on this real quickly last week, the RENA number, the Regional Housing Needs Assessment, and without boring our audience, that's a number that the state has come up with working with local governments about how much housing in different sectors for people with different incomes should each city should have. Now, they've had these numbers for years, but a lot of cities, Westlake, I think TO, they just don't meet them, and there really hasn't been.
Well, and it's just to clarify, they have to have a plan to have the housing. It's not to
they don't
like,
actually
be building
have to
this
build
stuff.
Them, right?
But some places like Westlake, it's 5.2 square miles, it's built out, and zoning, as you brought up, like they're discussing. We've discussed the North Regional Park specific plan of like turning industrial or business into residential, but. Yeah, it's a big problem. How do you find space for stuff when there's no space for stuff, except for moving on to new land?
And has Henry taken a position? Because, I mean, the governor went as so far as to say, you know, he would withhold possibly even gas tax funds from cities that didn't meet their numbers. Is he taking a position on, is there a way we can make these more enforceable without maybe going to the lengths of we're going to withhold gas tax money from cities? How do we get these numbers met, or are they just...
That's a fantastic question, and I'm not going to speak on Henry's behalf on that, but I will say that Henry was involved in a bill, SB 182, by Senator Hannah Beth Jackson, who's our neighboring district, that will work to relax some of the RENA numbers in very high fire severity zones. So taking where we feel that housing is almost dangerous to build, we'll look into relaxing some of those numbers. So 182 will affect Agora, Westlake, Calabasas, with these areas that have been designated very high fire severity zones. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's kind of the path we've taken on that.
Because it makes a great point. And Thousand Oaks the same way. I think our numbers are somewhere around 3,000 units, and everyone's saying, where are they going to go? But I think you hit on it. The thing I'm hearing now more and more is about the rezoning.
Yeah.
It's where retail was, will need housing there. Because, yeah, nobody wants to build into open space, right? I mean, we haven't seen that bill yet, right? I mean, as far as I know, that bill hasn't come out of Sacramento yet. But almost everything else has. But that continues to be coming up, is that these empty storefronts somehow making them, converting them into housing.
And I think that's very – there new iterations of housing bills will be introduced every year. It was SB 50 last year. Yeah. It was 9 this year. And next year it's definitely going to be something else. But it's the creative solutions, using existing footprints for business areas that are willing sellers, retrofitting them into housing. And I think that's so exciting. I think cities like Agora, Westlake, Calabasas, there's a lot of opportunity to explore this. Yeah. We need more affordable housing where young people can move in. You know, this single family home, American dream, is fantastic, but a lot of young people can't get there quite yet. So they need a starting place.
Yeah. And it's funny. I've talked to Henry about that a lot. I mean, he really can identify with that. He's told me when he had his apartment in Canoga Park, I'm sure he's not there anymore now that he's married, probably is a little nicer place. But even then, you know, he knows what it's like to try to find a place and not be able to afford it. I do want to get one more question. I think it's applicable, and hopefully you don't mind me asking. I also hear a lot about CEQA, you know, and the Environmental Quality Act. Is that too overburdensome on developers? Is there something there? Do you even want to go there? Is there something we could do there to make it less affordable, less burdensome on developers without hurting the environment? Or is that kind of like a non-starter?
So, I mean, whenever you bring up CEQA exemptions, it's very controversial. Yeah. I support CEQA. I think it's fantastic mechanism to keep things in balance. However, it's extremely burdensome, right? So it makes development, it makes things timely and expensive, right? But it does take into consideration the environment and the impacts. I think that there's some places that could look at CEQA exemptions and not having to go through the CEQA process if it's, you know, that it's not going to have an environmental impact. But if you're looking at development of open space, I fully support the entirety of the CEQA process. If you're looking at a home repair in a suburban neighborhood, a little bit different. If you're looking at, you know, something in urban settings, it's a little bit different. But when we're talking development, especially out here, fully support CEQA.
Yeah. Okay. Have there been bills that touch on that?
No, people don't really touch on that. CEQA is sacred in the environmental circles. Yeah. It's a sacred guardrail, I guess.
It seems like any senator going after that one would be risking.
Absolutely. But I work for the government, right? I'm not a developer. If I was in real estate, I would probably say, well, that's burdensome. It costs us too much money. But from the pair of glasses I'm looking at, it's wonderful and has preserved and protected our precious habitat.
Yeah. Well, that was great.
Yeah.
I think we've asked everything. Jeremy, thank you. Wow.
Any questions for us?
How many guests have you guys had?
This is episode 55, so I have no clue.
Wow.
Maybe around 20 guests?
Yeah, 20, 30 maybe.
What was the genesis of this?
Night at the bar.
Kind of, yeah. And it was funny. Ian said he's a musician, and he's like, I have the equipment if we want to do it. And we had always, the Acorns had always kind of talked about it, but we never had the willpower to do it. And now when Ian showed up with his equipment, we said, let's give it a go. And
I'm trying to build a monopoly. So then when I like threaten to take it away, I have grounds to raise.
Absolutely. I think it's brilliant. And I think that it's needed, and people love the Acorn.
Yeah.
People love the Acorn. Yeah. And I want to give a plug for myself. You're looking at 2015 top 10 Acorn people of the year. All right. But I had a full head of hair at that time.
Well, we appreciate it. We hope people are enjoying this. And we love having people on like you. Again, we have so many. That's what when Ian and I kind of thought this up, we said it can't just be Ian and I talking to each other. What really is great is having people like you that, you know, are informed on all these policy issues and just can educate people. We're hoping if they're not picking up their paper, shame on you, or going to the website, they'll listen to this and they'll learn a little bit more. So maybe next time you talk, they would have started on the wildlife bridge by then. I mean, that will be quite a milestone. Yeah.
And next time I see you guys in the studio, I'll be here with the senator.
Okay.
He's committed to coming.
Okay. All right. We're going to hold him to it.
All right. Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks so much for coming in, man.
Thank you.
So Jeremy's left the building. Great conversation.
I think we're on a roll now. We're kind of figuring this thing out. I think the key is that we get other people that have a lot of interesting things to say. I mean,
yeah, who'd have thought talking to the experts would make for good conversation?
But no, that was good. It gave another perspective, and we covered a lot of different topics there. And, you know, that's just another guy who's passionate about. I mean, it's amazing the people we have that come on that are from here. And
yeah.
The reason that they do this is because they grew up here and they care about it. And whether you agree with them or not, whether you agree with what Sean said last week or Jeremy said this week, they're both coming from a place of, hey, I think this is what's best for my community,
yeah,
and the place I grew up in and I plan to stay.
Yeah, shortly after I started here, I connected with Jeremy, and it was just one of those things like, oh, Jeremy Wolf is one of those guys you need to know. Like,
yep.
He's always ready to answer his phone. He's always, like, happy to hear from me and help me figure out what I need or put me in touch with a senator or anything like that. And you can tell, like, the creek cleanup, like, he's just a guy who loves his hometown and he wants,
yeah,
it to continue to be great. And like, again, like you say, whether you agree with him or not, you have to respect that.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and kind of self-serving, but he, again, when you grow up here, the Acorn, you kind of get it a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know what it's about, and you're willing to take the time to do something like this. So that was really good. So
yeah,
what's on the agenda for next week, Ian? Oh, let me look. Oh, yeah, nothing. We don't know.
No, I'm really flying by the seat of our pants here.
I'm committed. I'm going to try to find this candidate next week to come on if we
all
can.
Right.
If I can't, I'm sure we'll find someone else.
Well, Mr. Wolf is making a large promise about getting Henry Stern in here at some point in the next,
yeah,
couple weeks.
Well,
so
we'll have him soon enough.
Yeah.
But that was good. So, again, we'll get out of here. Thanks, everyone, for listening. This has been Kyle, Jory, Mask, and all. Follow me on Twitter at – I finally have one that fits me. Everyone saw that photo on Instagram and was joking that I had a six-year-old's mask on.
I need to get one.
This is one from Costco.
Yeah. I like this one, but I'm starting to realize it, like, pulls on my jaw in just the littlest way. So, like, I end up, like, kind of pulling it. Like, it's causing me jaw pain. Just the littlest bit.
Well, there's always one thing, right? Finding the search for the perfect mask. Maybe that should be our next episode. Because it's either you can't breathe in the thing. It either pulls on your ears. This seems pretty good, though. I don't know. I'm still touching, moving it around a lot. I just can't help doing that.
I noticed that it collapses inward around your mouth. I'm wondering if it's, like, ending up in between your teeth, like, when you're talking.
Yeah. So we'll see. Well, the search for the perfect mask. But again, Kyle Jory, editor of the Thousand Oaks Acorn. Follow me on Twitter at Kyle B. Jory.
This is Ian Bradley, a reporter for the Acorn newspapers. You can find me online at Ian_reports. That's IAN. If you want to follow Jeremy, he is on Twitter at Jeremy T. Wolf. If you go to Henry Stern's page, which is Henry Stern CA, yeah. I got it. If you go to his Twitter page, I'm sure you'll find a way to Jeremy's Twitter page pretty easily. But
stay tuned for your coverage about the wildlife bridge and the cougars and the mountain lions. There's a lot going on there. So
yeah,
please check out our websites. That's going to be a big story. And I think we had a story just post yesterday about the big cat that was killed on the freeway. So check that information out. And please tell your friends about this. Subscribe. Share the good word. We love talking to whoever's listening, but the more the merrier, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Our publisher would appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see y'all next week, folks.
See you guys.